A warning. This podcast uses the sound of gunshots, live reports, firsthand accounts, and other sounds related to active shootings. If you need crisis counseling related to shootings, the National Disaster Distress Hotline is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call 1-800-985-5990 or text 66746. If you know someone who may be a danger to the community or may be considering an act of violence yourself, please seek help. You can call your local authorities immediately. Many times you can be anonymous. Sandy Hook Promise also has a tip system called Say Something Tips. Just go to sandyhookpromise.org. It's November 14th, 2024, 865 days after a gunman dressed as a woman perched atop a vacant store, fired 83 rounds into the 4th of July parade crowd at the corner of Central Avenue and 2nd Street in Highland Park. Seven people were killed on July 4th, 2022. Dozens were hurt. Today, prosecutors from the Lake County, Illinois State's Attorney's Office are submitting evidence to be used at Robert Cremo III's 2025 trial. He faces 21 counts of first-degree murder, 48 counts of attempted murder, and 48 counts of aggravated battery. Now, this is normally where I'd plug in sound from the courtroom, but there are no cameras or microphones allowed. I'm in the second row of the jury box in a courtroom on the seventh floor of the Lake County, Illinois courthouse in Waukegan, Illinois, about 50 feet from the 100-something-pound, neck and face tattooed 23-year-old. For some reason, he showed up today. He actually flashed a peace sign after entering the courtroom to nobody in particular. The subtle gesture was noteworthy, considering he skipped out of his last couple case management hearings. Staying safe in his jail cell has prevented him from potentially confronting his victims, but also confronting the nearly airtight case that will be presented against him. His refusal to show up to this point hasn't sat well with Judge Victoria Rossetti, who in previous hearings warned Cremo's on-again, off-again defense team that the trial would go on whether he's here or not. Cremo's hair is shorter than his mugshot, but his sharp nose and chin features are clearly identifiable. In fact, that's something that a former student resource officer has testified to today. Highland Park Police Officer Brian Soldano was called in by the state's attorney's office to prove that the man dressed as a woman, seen in surveillance videos, was the same person he twice encountered as an SRO, both at Cremo's middle school, then again at his high school. These were low-level issues. Bobby was once found with cigarettes at his high school. But even as an adult, Soldano recognized Cremo's face in the video. Cremo's dad, Robert Cremo Jr., is sitting in the first row of benches directly behind his son. He's already served a month behind bars for endorsing his son's purchase of the Smith & Wesson M&P 15 semi-automatic rifle allegedly used at the parade. He signed off on the endorsement despite previous violent tendencies by his son, including threatening suicide. Cremo Jr. has always contended he had no idea his son would commit such a crime. Almost exactly a year ago to the date, Cremo Jr. himself was prosecuted by the Lake County State's Attorney. It's part of a growing legal tactic to charge the parents who could have stopped these types of tragedies from happening.
Today, the legal system has found Robert Cremo Jr. bears responsibility for endangering so many, and he himself has agreed that this was a crime.
As you all know, this matter was going to be tried first before his son's case was going to be tried. This would mean that the potential key evidence would be disclosed to the public, jeopardizing his son's fair right to trial. As a father, Mr. Cremo wanted to ensure that his son received a fair trial.
This sends a very strong message in a way that's unprecedented in the history of our state.
Similar cases include the father of the 2018 Waffle House shooter in Nashville, Tennessee. He was sentenced to 18 months in prison. The parents of the 2021 Oxford, Michigan high school shooter got 10 to 15 years each.
We find the defendant guilty of involuntary manslaughter.
They're now appealing. And the father of the 2024 Winder, Georgia high school shooter faces more than two dozen charges.
Four counts of involuntary manslaughter, two counts of second degree murder, and 8 counts of cruelty to children.
Cremo's father pleaded guilty to reckless conduct and served a month of his 60-day sentence behind bars before being released. At one point during his own trial, Cremo Jr. wore a white T-shirt that read, "I'm a political pawn." The judge, who was not Rossetti, scolded him for it. The father is back in the courtroom for his son, wearing just a plain shirt today. He still has a year left on his 2-year probation. Just to his left is his ex-wife and Bobby's mom, Denise Piscina. She tried at least once today to get her son's attention in court, but the two muscular Lake County corrections officers between them made it clear to Bobby to keep his eyes forward. But Denise is taking in the courtroom scene, her eyes darting around the gathered crowd on the public benches to her left and behind her, which include a mix of about 3 dozen people. Some are victims, some are community members, some are law school students. But the courtroom isn't completely full today. Cell phone use is banned in the courtroom. Devices were confiscated at the door and put into sealed bags that can be picked up after today's hearing. Everyone was wanded on the way in, lest anyone try to get revenge on the suspect in person with a weapon or smuggle in equipment to live stream today's hearing. As I mentioned earlier, no cameras or microphones are allowed. I'm in the jury box with about 10 other members of the media from local newspapers and TV stations. I believe I'm the only radio person here. One of the seats on the rundown from the public information officer is reserved for CNN, but I don't know if that person's actually here. Occasionally, I see Denise's eyes glance in our direction. Victims are trying to catch covert glimpses of Bobby, but seemingly not knowing if they really want to lay eyes on the guy. Lake County Sheriff's officers are carefully watching the crowd. I'm not concealing anything. My eyes are on Bobby. Looking for any emotion, any reaction, anything really. Who is this guy? What does he think about this stage that's been set for his eventual trial? Did he think people would show? Who does he think is behind this protective wall of muscled corrections officers? Does he want to see what he did to them? Does he want to apologize? Is he expecting compassion, wrath? Why did he show up today after skipping the last 2 hearings? And why did he flash a peace sign? Just like the public, we in the media have been told we cannot send out emails or text messages from this courtroom. But we are allowed to use our cell phones or laptops to take notes. I actually left my cell phone and laptop in the car, thinking I wouldn't get into the media box, and now I'm regretting it. I could have taken notes for my newsroom, have them all written up, ready to go, and just hit send when today's hearing's over. But now I'm confined to the old school pen and paper, wishing I had parked a little closer to the front door. A female TV reporter, one row in front of me, is clearly pounding out text messages to people. I can't tell if it's to her news desk, her photographer downstairs, or if these are personal messages, but either way, it's frustrating. Over the last year, I've reached out to Bobby, sending him a handful of letters to the Lake County Jail. I started sending them after seeing a 2023 story that he had prank called the New York Post with a lame, "Is your refrigerator running" bit while behind bars. His phone privileges have since been revoked by the judge. He has responded to my letters. We'll get to that later. The truth is, I shouldn't be here. There are more important stories going on, and I've got bigger things to worry about than this guy and a shooting that took place more than 2 years ago. I shouldn't be trying to talk to him. I shouldn't be saying his name. I certainly shouldn't have invited him onto this podcast. This, after all, is a monster, accused of killing 7 members of his own community during a public celebration. Prosecutors say he then drove to Wisconsin where he was going to shoot up another parade. I'm still saying allegedly, but based on the evidence we've seen so far and the letters he sent to me, I don't think anyone in this courtroom would dispute who the gunman was that day. But I guess we'll see how it plays out at the trial. Bobby was taken into custody following a traffic stop the day of the shooting. Video from the scene shows his tatted face down on the ground, arms behind his back. If you had just pulled up to this scene, you'd probably assume it was some kind of drug bust. The shooting happened July 4th, 2022, 14 miles from my home. I've been to Highland Park quite a bit. I've actually been to the Highland Park 4th of July parade before. I wasn't there that day. I was at home on my final day of getting over COVID, but I knew exactly what to expect. I knew who would speak and when. I knew how we in the media would cover it. There's a bit of a news playbook. Nobody's written it down, but you lean on what you know. And the media knows how to cover these shootings. Let's start from the beginning. News desks will hear about a so-called mass shooting in 3 ways. First, via social media. Platforms like Dataminer send newsrooms high-priority tweets in almost real time. So if someone tweets out, "OMG, someone's shooting," or "There's a lot of people shot here right now," a few comments, a few likes, and retweets later, that algorithm will kick in, and this is destined for a newsroom inbox in short time. A data miner email can also be triggered by law enforcement advising people with somewhat of a cryptic message to avoid an area due to police activity. Doesn't always mean a shooting, but in many cases it does. The second is a good old-fashioned scanner. Once you start hearing multiple ambulances sent to an area because of multiple victims, it's probably time to scramble a reporter. And the third is if another media outlet is reporting it, likely because they've got a reporter or an insider who may already be there or was there when it happened. We tend to be a herd industry, so if someone else is reporting it, it's probably time to start sending reporters. These so-called mass shootings last just minutes from start to finish. According to Alice Training, one of the leaders in active shooter training in the U.S., from the time someone starts shooting to the time they've been killed themselves, fled, or been taken into custody, it's about 19 minutes, with the deadliest time happening in those first 10 minutes. Police are typically there within 15 minutes, but as you know, information about these shootings takes hours. So how do you fill that time from the first shot fired to the first real answers? As a TV or radio anchor at the studio in a so-called mass shooting, first you talk to witnesses on the phone. Who's there? What stores or homes are nearby? What can those people tell us?
How far away are you?
Steps. We can actually hear the helicopters above us right now. And there's a lot of police officers and FBI and SWAT outside. We know that we could see them outside of our window a little bit ago.
Most people are confused. Some may not be directly involved. Some may be hiding, but they have something, some information, a message or emotion they want to get out there.
It just broke my heart. It just did. But I'm here for Jesus. He sent me to pray in this school.
Now, if you're the first reporter at the scene, you probably don't have a lot of information either. So the first thing you report on is what you're seeing. Scared people, police tape, blood on the street, tactical units showing up, how many ambulances were sent, even just the landscape.
Beautiful area, white picket fences, rolling hills, horse country. There's about 1,900 students that attend the high school behind me. There's a preschool directly across from me, a middle school, elementary school.
Once you're finally able to grab a witness, you're looking for that all-encompassing line.
It's scary to be here in our city.
I never saw something like this happen in Fordyce, Arkansas.
This is the first time that anything has happened like this here since I've been here.
There might also be a line in there about guns and how this has to stop.
Just put the guns down, man.
Now, if it's a school, photographers will try to get that Columbine-style image of scared kids walking with their hands up in the air, surrounded by police, and parents rushing to the school, crying because they don't know what's going on. Information in that first hour or two is usually limited, so reporters will talk about police going from room to room, searching for victims and the suspect. And they'll grab anyone willing to talk, a mayor, a council member, a former police officer, a local business owner. You'll hear about nearby schools and businesses on lockdown out of precaution and rumors of a second shooting or a second gunman.
You're saying they. Do you mean multiple shooters or are you referring to the responders?
So we mean multiple shooters. We believe there's more than one, maybe two, a couple more. We're not sure. Everyone we've been talking to and we've been listening to a police broadcast station. So we believe there's more than one.
By the way, rarely is there more than one gunman. The media will do its due diligence and reach out to responding police departments, but usually those departments are too busy to talk and they don't have confirmed information. Those who do talk, you'll have to take that information with a grain of salt. Sometimes they're getting it second or third hand. You'll probably eventually get a short statement from the FBI or ATF saying they're monitoring the situation or are now assisting in the situation, which gives the anchor something new to say and automatically upgrades the shooting to national status. At that point, news networks will begin to send their own reporters to the scene rather than rely on the local reporters and images. But this is all just filler. This is just the lead up to what people really want to know. How bad was this one? And that first police press conference won't give anyone the information they want.
Just after 1 o'clock this morning, we had an active shooter situation in the Oregon District, part of our downtown area in the 400 block of East 5th Street. We had one shooter that we are aware of and multiple victims.
You probably won't find out how many people were hurt or who the gunman is, what weapon the gunman used, where he went, if he's alive or a motive. I say he because historically speaking, an overwhelming majority of the shooters have been male, although a couple recent shootings are starting to dull that narrative. There will be a vague reference to multiple people shot and that investigators are in contact with multiple law enforcement agencies.
Homicide Bureau is working closely with Chief Scott Weiss and his agency at the Monterey Park Police Department. We're working with the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, LA office, and numerous other law enforcement agencies.
There may be a point when media outlets will start citing sources of how many people were shot, either based on unnamed sources, their own information from witnesses they've talked to, or even other media outlets. Sometimes they're right. Many times these first reports are wrong.
CNN reporting 4 dead, approximately 30 injured. Again, that is coming from CNN, which is, of course, a greater number than what we had heard originally from NBC reporting.
The governor and other political leaders are usually involved in the big press conference, where we know how many people were killed, hurt, and what happened to the suspect. This usually means the shooting is settled. The gunman is dead or in custody. The media will ask further questions about motive and what kind of weapon was used, but investigators won't reveal that information until days, maybe weeks later. The first vigil is typically held that afternoon or evening, a combination of faith-based groups and city leaders.
We're very strong together, and we're going to continue to be strong throughout this tragic event.
The liberal leaders will talk about guns.
Raising the age of purchase for a weapon originally designed for war.
Conservative leaders will talk about mental health.
He is a very sick puppy. It was a very, very sick guy. Not too many people knew about it, but now that they're looking, they're starting to see. He had a lot of problems, a lot of trouble.
In the coming months, there will be local and statewide efforts to curb similar style violence in the future, but will not rise to national action. I know this because Highland Park was the 10th so-called mass shooting I covered. While the closest to my house, this was far from the deadliest.
Good morning, Ryan. What are you seeing there this morning?
Good morning. Well, we're still seeing tables overturned, some chairs overturned. Really, it's kind of a space that's frozen in time. Less than 24 hours after that shooting took place, police have not come in and swept through. People have not been able to go back and pick up their belongings.
Just as an ABC News correspondent from 2015 to 2020, I was called at 3 in the morning and sent to Las Vegas for the Route 91 Harvest shooting. Visible from the memorial, the broken windows on the 32nd floor at Mandalay Bay, where the gunman opened fire. I was sent to Parkland, Florida on Valentine's Day 2018. When gunshots were heard, Kelsey Friend says she hid inside of a classroom under a desk with other students, and the door was wide open. I was sent to the 2019 Dayton shooting early on a Sunday morning. For Katie Howerton, the nightmare of the shooting will remain. She lives next to Ned Peppers and watched the tragedy unfold from her apartment. On my wedding anniversary in 2015, I was sent to 4 Marines shot and killed in a rampage in Chattanooga.
Now hundreds of flowers, banners, and American flags litter the grassy strip in front of the recruiting center.
Recruiter scene right there is where I signed my papers.
I was sent to Kalamazoo in 2016 after an Uber driver shot and killed 6 people, seemingly at random.
Sisters-in-law Mary Lou Nye and Mary Jo Nye were among the 5 people gunned down while in a parking lot outside of a Cracker Barrel restaurant Saturday night.
In February of 2019, I reported on a Friday night in the freezing temperatures from Aurora, Illinois, for a workplace shooting at the Henry Pratt Company.
An Aurora City spokesperson does tell us that the officers who were injured are in stable condition.
In February of 2020, I was sent to the workplace shooting at the Molson Coors Brewery in Milwaukee that left 5 dead.
Milwaukee Police Chief Alfonso Morales, to this point, only publicly identifying the gunman as
a 51-year-old Milwaukee man who was found deceased inside one of the buildings.
In 2018, I was sent to Marshall County, Kentucky, for the high school shooting that left 2 students dead and 14 hurt. By the way, the 15-year-old gunman survived. The student was eventually taken into custody with a nonviolent apprehension.
The 15-year-old is going to be charged with murder.
Most of this was over just a 5-year span. It can wear on you. It wore on me. And we'll get to that in a little bit. For Las Vegas and Parkland, I was there for a week. If the shooting is big enough, usually the national media will stay until the president arrives. President Biden went to Uvalde, Texas, and Lewistown, Maine. President Trump went to the hospital to visit survivors of the Las Vegas shooting. He visited law enforcement following the Parkland shooting. He went to Pittsburgh following the Tree of Life shooting in 2018. He also made 2 stops during the back-to-back shootings in El Paso and Dayton in 2019. President Obama went to Orlando, Fort Hood, Sandy Hook, and of course sang Amazing Grace at the Memorial for Reverend Clementa Pinckney following the shooting at the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound.
That's not always the case, though. In Marshall County, Kentucky, with only 2 students dead, my assignment lasted less than 48 hours. Workplace shootings like Molson Coors in Milwaukee and Henry Pratt in Aurora, Illinois, usually don't have as long of a national news cycle shelf life. Coverage may vary not only on the number of victims, but if the victims knew the shooter, or if the victims were adults or children, or if there was a racist, homophobic, or terrorism angle to the story. That's not to say that all of these weren't taken seriously, but the American news attention span only lasts so long. But the mental impact it takes on these communities, and the reporters who cover them, takes much longer. I'm Ryan Burrow. Welcome to Interrupting the Next Mass Shooting. This docuseries dives deep into the data, research, and witness testimony for more than two decades of mass shootings in America. What's working? What isn't? How do we break this cycle? The goal here isn't to relive the pain and the horror. It's not to blame politicians or policies. We're really good at that. The goal actually is to enlighten you on the true stories of these shootings, help you define them, and show us what we can do in our own communities, in our schools, in our churches, in our families, to break this cycle. This is a uniquely American problem. But we've now got 25 years of data since Columbine. We've got shooter profiles, updated security plans, training exercises, and new laws and regulations. So it's time to stop thinking about these shootings and talking about them the same way we did in 1999. Let's reduce them all together. Republicans, Democrats, rural communities, urban communities, pro-gun, anti-gun. In this series, we're going to break down the four points of a mass shooting, from the decision a future shooter makes to the wake left behind in a devastated community. But our goal is to stop these from happening in the first place. So we're actually going to reverse the order and truly look at what we can do at each one of these points to interrupt the cycle. Now, this is a concept I've been working on for years, accumulating hundreds of pages of documents, emails, articles, audio and video files, photos I've taken myself. I've talked with government officials, city leaders, law enforcement, lawyers, victims, psychologists, and researchers. I pitched this concept and themes to multiple documentarians, multiple producers. The feedback, while positive, has never actually led to anything. Multiple producers have told me people just aren't interested in solutions-based journalism right now. They want drama, specifically true crime and celebrity. This doesn't necessarily fall in that vein. So here's a podcast to put all of this planning, all this strategy, all this research and experience out into the public. From my perspective, this project is going to make all those sleepless nights, all that sorrow and fear and built-up anxiety worthwhile. Eventually, not always, but if you're lucky, as you move through therapy, you stop being afraid, you stop trying to avoid, you stop doing the same thing, and you start to become curious. Success here is not a popular podcast. Success is that you're here right now, you're listening to it, you're open to new thoughts, new ideas, new understandings. You've become curious. You may have thoughts already on guns and mental health, white teenage boys, racists, homophobes, politicians, and school security. You're going to come away with a new understanding of how we in the media cover these shootings, what we do wrong, what kinds of conversations result from these shootings, what kind of emotional states they put the public in, what traps we all fall into, what real hard research shows, and what makes someone choose to kill. This is Interrupting Mass Shootings, Chapter 1, Part 1, The Aftermath. Here's a minute of mass shooting data from the Violence Project. More than half of mass shootings have occurred since 2000, one-third since 2010. The deadliest year was 2018 with 9 incidents, followed by 7 in 2017 and 2019. Mass shooting deaths average 51 per year, with a sharp increase over the last decade. Over that same decade, homicides nationwide have mostly decreased. More than 1,200 people have been killed in mass shootings in the U.S. since 1966. 60% of the victims are male, 40% female, 64% white, 17% Latinx, 10% black. No other nation has produced that many victims over that period. The U.S. produced a third of the mass shootings worldwide. 85% of mass shooters were born and raised in the U.S. 40% of the mass shooters since 1998 were millennials. 28% of mass shootings are workplace shootings. That's more than school, places of worship, and public spaces. 63% of shooters had a previous violent history. Thank you. chapter is focusing on the aftermath. Most communities choose to remember the tragedies, or more importantly, the victims, but it's a delicate balance between remembering the horror and honoring the victims. It's a process that can take years of consideration, input, and fundraising. In Newtown, Connecticut, Sandy Hook Elementary was leveled following the 2012 shooting that left 26 dead, including 20 small children. A new school was opened in its place 4 years later, but as Avi Steinberg of the New York Times Magazine reported at the opening there in 2016, there was no memorial, no physical evidence of the tragedy that took place there. Now, in 2022, 10 years after the shooting, a memorial was set up not far from the school. It consists of a stone wall with the names of the victims surrounding a sycamore tree. In 2024, Broward County Schools demolished one of the buildings at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, 7 years after the shooting that left 17 people, mostly students, dead. The district announced it reached the decision to demolish the building in consultation with health and safety experts and out of concern for the well-being of students and staff on campus. After years of back and forth and numerous proposals, the city of Orlando has purchased the site of the 2016 Pulse nightclub shooting that left 49 people dead. The city is now getting public feedback on turning that space into a future memorial. In Las Vegas, a healing garden was built near the Las Vegas Strip to honor the 58 killed in the Route 91 Harvest shooting. A series of granite pillars, greenery, and beaming lights in El Paso commemorate the 23 people killed at a Walmart there in 2019. In 2024, Dayton, Ohio unveiled the Seed of Life Memorial 5 years after 9 people were killed by a gunman in the city's popular Oregon district. In May of 2024, a memorial was dedicated outside the Tops grocery store in Buffalo, New York, where 10 people were killed in a racist attack in 2022. And there's even a memorial garden outside of Cole Hall at Northern Illinois University, where 6 students were shot and killed by a classmate on Valentine's Day 2008. These are just a few. There's actually a nonprofit group called the 720 Foundation. It was founded following the shooting at the Aurora, Colorado movie theater that left 13 dead. It helped create the memorial garden featuring 83 cranes, including 13 that are rising up to the sky. Now the group works to help communities impacted by mass tragedy. In Highland Park, Illinois, the city's trying to strike that balance, remembering the victims of the July 4, 2022 attack, while avoiding re-traumatizing the people with the violence associated with that day. Highland Park is an extremely affluent northern suburb of Chicago. The average income is about $160,000, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. The population of 30,000 is loaded with doctors, lawyers, even celebrities like Smashing Pumpkins frontman Billy Corgan. Michael Jordan's former home is in Highland Park. There's been a concerted effort to apply trauma-informed principles when talking about the shooting that day. The Highland Park communications manager sent me an 18-page document from the city of Highland Park with guidance to the media and the community about best practices for having conversations, holding remembrances, and even covering the events of that day and beyond. Now, none of this is binding, obviously. The media and community members can use the words they want to use and present information the way they want to present it. But this has been and continues to be an evolution. Here are some examples. According to the guidance, people should avoid using the word strong. That was a bit of a surprise to me, seeing so many of the pictures I took from these incidents include signs, chalkings, and shirts that read things like Las Vegas Strong and Dayton Strong. But the guidance suggests using the word strong can set unrealistic expectations for the resiliency of the victims and their family members. The recommended term instead is united or together. Another recommendation specific to Highland Park, do not refer to what took place on July 4, 2022 as the 4th of July shooting or the parade shooting. The goal here is to separate the violence from the annual holiday and event. It's been a challenge for us in the media. We're mostly willing to follow along, but admittedly, it can become a bit tedious when writing these news stories. Interestingly enough, Highland Park shooting is the recommended phrase, though the communications director admits to me that's tough from a city marketing standpoint. It's also recommended to limit references to anniversaries. That can create emotional attachment to dates and make it challenging for victims to move forward. Though we in the media do that quite frequently, right? 9/11, October 7th. Remembrance is the preferred term over anniversary. Some of the recommended words include resiliency over healing, journey over recovery, move forward instead of move on, and re-traumatize over trigger. These are just to name a few. And one phrase the city of Highland Park recommends avoiding is lives lost. The preferred phrase is lives taken. The thought being the latter phrase accurately conveys the severity of the situation. This guidance, of course, comes out as Highland Park is moving forward with a plan for a remembrance location, a place where people can actually gather together. I had a chance to talk with the city's mayor, Nancy Rotering, about that. So a day after the shooting happened, I interviewed you and you talked to me about a playbook you had received outlining how you, as a government leader, should handle what was happening and what needed to happen moving forward. At the time, you seemed a bit surprised that this playbook existed. Your communication director actually shared it with me. It's about 18 pages long. Was this a guide that actually helped you through the process in the wake of the shooting?
Absolutely. The United on Guns, there's a 24-hour protocol for the first 24 hours after a community experiences a mass shooting. And then there's the playbook for and then what comes next for ever after. And it was sent to me by then Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley. And within 45 minutes of our event, the interesting part is obviously the first 24 hours after a mayor's experienced something like this, you don't even have time to look at the playbook or the protocol. But since then, our city manager and I have been working with the group that produces this, United on Guns, Sarah Peck, and provided them with our input as well. But it's when I've talked to other mayors who've had this experience, we discuss how it's very similar and very unique to each community. Obviously, all communities are unique, but the human response to something like this is obvious and typical. So it's important to know what to expect for our community and for every community. It's important that people recognize the pain and the sadness that has come from what's occurred, as well as the fear, and not make it a political statement filled with anger. At that moment, people are absolutely mourning. And so it's important to show compassion to the community in the immediate aftermath.
Is it valuable to have something like this in mayor's hands before one of these incidents takes place? I mean, I'm assuming they've got access to it, but you probably weren't prepared. I mean, I don't know how you can prepare for that situation, but I suppose it's some materials that can be available.
It's absolutely available. It's publicly available. And there are numerous mayors' organizations, primarily the U.S. Conference of Mayors and the National League of Cities. And at their annual and more frequently than that conferences, this is always a topic of conversation. I just came back from the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Washington last weekend. There are full seminars about what to expect and how to prepare, because America's mayors unfortunately know it's not a matter of if, but when something like this is going to come to your community. So people do know and people are aware. A few years ago, I literally was sitting in that meeting. It was prior to 2022, and the mayor of Seattle had to leave during the meeting because a mass shooting had occurred in her community. So unfortunately, it's all too common. This is something that we obviously have to fight against normalizing. But at the moment, the resources are available. And all of the mayors who are unfortunate members of this club reach out to one another in the immediate aftermath. I've been in touch with several mayors within an hour, just as Nan Whaley was to me, because it is just a horrific and overwhelming occurrence.
This booklet here, I assume it's a breathing, it's constantly evolving, it's constantly changing. I mean, is it something that you contributed to? Is it something that down the road more mayors are contributing to kind of build this out? It's already 200 pages, but I can imagine there's more information as we learn more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And my city manager, Gita Newkirk, and I have met a couple of times with Sarah Peck and United on Guns to give them our input. Just lessons learned, important opportunities to help other communities who may have this horror come to their doorstep.
Almost 3 years later, you've been pursuing a project called HP Remembrance. What is that?
Well, we're working on a place of remembrance. We, in the immediate aftermath, had several organic memorials sort of pop up. But as communities try to move forward from the immediate horror and pain, it's important to be cognizant of people's emotions, the baggage that they've brought to the event, and then their reactions after the event. So we moved our temporary place of remembrance to a space just a little bit off of the main road that the event occurred on, because, again, we didn't want to re-trigger people. We had conversations with the U.S. Department of Justice Office for Victims of Crime, and they specifically mentioned that it was important for people to not have to come upon reminders every single day of their lives when they're going about their normal business, but to opt into having this time of remembrance, reflection, solace, if you were. So we've moved it to an area near City Hall. It's a rose garden. People come periodically. It's a place, obviously, for people to gather in remembrance on the 4th of July. And so now we're in the process of getting the public support and input in terms of where they want a permanent place of remembrance to be placed. And it's important to note, we are using specifically those phrases, place of remembrance. Memorial obviously specifies loss of life. And we start every meeting where we're discussing this place with a moment of silence to remember the seven people who were killed on July 4th, 2022. But we also know that dozens of people were injured and have survived. We also know that thousands of people were present, not injured, but traumatized. So it's important for us when we talk about this place, that it's a place that we remember. We remember those who we lost. We remember the experience. And we also provide a place of solace and also information for future generations to come. Obviously, this is now part of our story, and we want to be able to tell it in a way that's trauma-informed, sensitive to those who survived, sensitive to those who suffered grievous losses, but also those who may be curious to better understand what the impact is of something like this on a community. So we're leaning into both providing a place to remember, but also a place to, frankly, highlight the resilience and strength of our community.
It's got to be a difficult balance to try to remember when a lot of people do want to forget. Has there been any pushback?
No. I mean, obviously, there are people who are still in such deep pain or dealing with still unbelievable physical and social and emotional impacts from this event that they want to just focus on their own journey and moving forward. But there are others who also recognize it. And I have to highlight, this is a super supportive community, very, very compassionate, people who want to be able to continue to support each other and also recognize the need for folks to have a quiet place to reflect and remember.
And I'm sure that you've done your research. I'm sure that your office has done its research. I mean, these places of remembrance can take years. I mean, Sandy Hook, Parkland, I mean, there are places it's taken a decade in some situations. Are you prepared? I mean, you're in the process now. I mean, is that something that you're prepared for it to take a while to really hone in and land on something specific?
We recognized that we needed to be thoughtful and deliberate in our planning. We are now in the process of gathering public input in terms of location and elements that people are looking for. We've also done a lot of research. I myself have been to several places of remembrance, not only in the U.S., but elsewhere in the world, just better understanding the design, the impact on the neighbors, the impact on the broader community, the importance in terms of the broad scheme of the story of the impacts of gun violence on our United States. So it's been a very long journey. And we recognize that we need to take into account so many different voices, because there are so many different perspectives of what this event did to our community and to individuals. So we are taking our time. That being said, we don't want it to drag on forever. It's important to have this place right now while people are working through their emotions and their memories of the situation, their trauma. So we're moving forward. I think we're in a good place in terms of the timing. And I'll be honest, we've been in touch with folks from Newtown and folks from Orlando and folks from San Bernardino. And I could go on and on and on, because unfortunately, the list is really long in this country.
Obviously, you want to make something that's unique to Highland Park, though. You don't want to just have a cookie cutter, space.
Absolutely. And from talking to those folks, we recognize the value and the importance of doing a nationwide requests for qualifications, requests for proposals, and making it special and unique to Highland Park. So it's important to know we're super grateful to John and Mindy Gray. John Gray grew up in Highland Park, left at the age of 18 to go pursue his life and his successes. They donated $1 million in the immediate aftermath of the shooting towards this permanent place of remembrance. So we're so appreciative to them. We will obviously be needing other resources as we move forward because we do want to make it appropriate and special for the people of Highland Park and frankly, the folks who were visiting on that day who also were impacted.
And as your office and the city have been kind of navigating this time period, you guys gave me the communication practices, best practices. This is evolving too. And this is basically, well, I'll tell you what, why don't you explain this to me, applying trauma-informed principles to conversations and writings about the shooting.
Right. And this was something that was put together by our team. They did an amazing job. And now it also has gone out into the country. Because when you are talking about something as horrific and impactful as a mass shooting, obviously, you want to be sensitive in how you're reporting and how you're communicating. Now, obviously, we recognize the importance of the First Amendment, the freedom of speech. People can say what they wish. But just in an effort, again, to be compassionate towards those who have suffered grievous loss or the horror of being shot at, we try to use specific words and not use other words. And so that's what that's all about. It's just sort of an opportunity to share information that we've pulled together in this journey that we've been on.
And I think this is, I mean, part of this was for you guys in your conversation. Some of it was also filtered to us in the media to kind of rethink how we're discussing this, because obviously people are listening to us, watching us as well. Just a couple I wanted to highlight. Avoid July 4 shooting or parade shooting. The rationale is separating the violent incident from the annual holiday supports long-term resiliency. That's got to be hard, because even though it sounds like a great concept, it's got to be hard to communicate that to someone like me in the media. Don't refer to it as the 4th of July shooting.
Right. I mean, we are trying to regain this holiday, both for our celebration of our country, but more so for our children. And when John Gray made his wonderfully generous donation, he literally noted, "I have great memories of being a kid in the 4th of July parade." And so last year was the first year we had the parade. It was a definitely scaled down event. What was most poignant to me was while we were marching, seeing the tears running down faces of people on the sidelines because they so desperately want to have these memories be happy memories and not the painful emotional memories. So to that point, it's the Highland Park shooting because we don't want to, frankly, destroy this holiday. What's interesting to me, I have third graders come through every spring and we talk about involvement in city government. And the first year we had the third graders come back after the shooting, one of them raised her hand and said, "Do we ever get to celebrate the 4th of July again?" And I had to fight tears. And I said, "Absolutely, we will celebrate the 4th of July again." So it's with that question, with those kids in mind, that we put this sort of suggestion out there that we take back the 4th of July. And we did that the first year after the event when we had our community walk and 5,000 people said, "We are reclaiming our parade route because this is our community and violence doesn't define who we are."
As the mayor of Highland Park, though, I'm sure that you want to boost the city and you don't want to become. I understand the rationale behind Highland Park shooting, but as the mayor, you probably don't want people to associate Highland Park with the shooting.
Absolutely. And it doesn't define us. What defines us is a community of strong, resilient, compassionate neighbors who continue to support one another. And we will lean into that in our planning of this place of remembrance. And we've been leaning into that, obviously, as we've been talking about our community in the general conversation. This one event, this one guy with a weapon who shot off 83 rounds in under a minute, he doesn't get to define our community.
One of the other ones I just want to throw out there is not using the term anniversary. It creates emotional attachments. Dates can make it challenging for victims to move forward. I'm sure this is all great. And by the way, this about 25 pages or 18 pages or so. I'm sure it's hard to follow. I'm sure you guys got training on it, but you know, there are a lot of things, do this, don't do that, that it's going to take some time. And admittedly, it says this is constantly changing as well. So you're prepared that 5 years from now, some of this stuff we could end up crossing out and using some other terminology.
And again, just to be clear, this is a recommendation. We're just trying to be compassionate to those who really suffered grievous losses and unbelievable pain. So we appreciate your cooperation.
Yeah, no problem. I find it fascinating because I don't see you as trying to rebrand that day. I think that, you know, you can't, you know, put the PR cycle in and say, hey, let's pretend that day didn't happen or let's make it sound better than it was. But you obviously need to remind people that, hey, we are a great city and we are coming together in all of this. Have events, I mean, you referenced the parade and that coming back. Have events left? Have businesses left? Have people left as a result of the shooting?
No. I think at the end of, I mean, we provided significant support to our businesses who were impacted. We're experiencing a bit of a renaissance in terms of businesses coming to Highland Park. So we have, we are stronger in the aftermath. We are, I think, more communicative with one another, more caring for one another, more sensitive to one another. But no, not at all. We are, we're stronger than ever. And that's a testament to this great community.
Do you run the city differently than you did before July 4th, 2022?
I don't think so. We always have been a community of neighbors who've been very supportive of one another. I don't see that at all. No, we've maybe communicating more, obviously, around this issue and continuing to provide mental health care support to folks, communicating to others about resources that they may need. For example, in the aftermath of the Kansas City Chiefs parade shooting after the Super Bowl, we knew that people would be triggered in our community as they were. So we made sure to put more information out about access to mental health care. There's probably more funding going towards mental health care, but frankly, who in this country doesn't need more mental health care resources at all? So I think that's probably the one change has been putting more resources and more accessibility to mental health care.
Do you find more togetherness since that time in the city, or everything is just kind of chugging along back how it was?
In some ways we do, and in some ways we are like the rest of the country in terms of the polarization that people seem to be experiencing. But I think there's a heightened sensitivity to caring for one another and recognizing that tragedy can come in a minute and appreciating one another. Absolutely.
What are some of the next steps now for you and the city here moving forward? You mentioned, obviously, the place of remembrance.
Right. So we are actually continuing that process. We're meeting fairly frequently. We just wrapped up some focus groups with people who were directly impacted. And then the general public, we're gathering all kinds of information as we prepare to move forward with some recommendations to the city council about what to do with the place of remembrance. We are already making plans for 4th of July, 2025. And working on that parade and the 4th Fest. So we are bringing 4th of July back even stronger for the community. And life goes on in Highland Park.
Where can people find out more information or kind of keep track on what you guys are doing? Or maybe they've got recommendations or suggestions.
We're always open to hearing people's recommendations. Cityhpil.com is our website. We have a page on there for Resilient Highland Park, Place of Remembrance, and we would love people's input for specific suggestions related to the Place of Remembrance.
Are you as a city making preparations for the trial that's coming up here? Are there any additional things that you guys are doing?
Actually, we can't talk about that because of court orders. So,
sure. Okay.
We know that it's beginning February 24th. So that's all I can say.
All right. Thank you so much, Mayor. I really appreciate you joining me.
Thank you, Ryan.
As a final note on this topic of remembering, I would be remiss if I failed to mention the name Greg Zanis. For about a decade, this retired carpenter from Aurora, Illinois, would jump into his truck almost immediately following a tragic event. Not necessarily shootings, but really any tragedy where multiple people died. And each time he'd bring stand-up memorial crosses, remembering each and every victim killed.
Yeah, I just don't feel like there's anything I can do but help try to remember.
Greg was known by many who covered these tragedies as the crossman and the second responder. He founded what he called Crosses for Losses. He was there in Parkland. He was there in Las Vegas. He drove from El Paso to Dayton to deliver crosses, paying tribute to those who innocently lost their lives on those back-to-back shootings.
In the last 2 years, I've been to Texas four times for mass shootings. And the pressure of going to Dayton and just never realized that I do let all this bother me.
And those are just a handful of the places he visited. If you watch any coverage of these shootings dating back to Columbine, you probably saw Greg's crosses. Didn't matter if the victims were Christian or even religious, he wanted to honor them. Greg even had to deliver crosses to his own hometown following the workplace shooting at Henry Pratt in 2019.
Very simple. I'm not a politician, not a gun guy, I'm not a church guy. I just want families to have their children remembered.
I interviewed him a couple times. The wooden crosses themselves may not comfort, but they created a nearly instant healing space. You can't gather around bullet fragments, broken glass, and police tape. But Greg knew you can gather around crosses, even if it's outside of the crime scene. Those crosses became a centralized place for a community to come out, see the names, drop flowers, say a prayer, cry, chalk messages, leave pictures, and light a candle. Permanent memorials can take years, but Greg gave people space to grieve in the immediate wake of an attack. He died in 2020 of bladder cancer. Groups and individuals have picked up the torch. You'll likely see wooden structures placed at these tragic scenes today. Admittedly, since Greg's death, I haven't dug into who these people are. The photos I took in the 2022 Highland Park shooting featured blue hearts instead of crosses. But either way, I'm sure Greg is proud.
I'm trying to show something that's not around anymore. That's love and compassion and showing somebody you love them and doing something for them.
On interrupting the next mass shooting. Is it difficult to not be a so-called ambulance chaser in these situations?
I call them the ambulance chasers of trauma. And so I always tell people, like, the people who show up and knock on your door are the ones who want to write a book and sensationalize this or write a documentary. And that doesn't serve your community or, more importantly, the most impacted individuals.